You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, interviews from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s with voices from the past.
It's a peculiar way liberals talk. Conservatives are far less prone to the sloganeering and the talking points. What the Tea Partiers, by and large, are doing is reading the Constitution and talking about the Constitution.
Conservative commentator Ann Coulter, today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Bill Thompson. Well, it's no secret that Americans are more politically divided than ever, and that has raised a number of questions about why we're so split. Why do conservatives think the way they do? Why do liberals think the way they do? Well, a few years ago, conservative commentator Ann Coulter came up with what she thought was a good explanation. She put it in a book called Demonic: How the Liberal Mob is Endangering America. The essence of her theory is that liberals, Democrats, are in fact following a mob mentality. As you listen to this interview, keep in mind we did this a number of years ago before Donald Trump, before MAGA. So here now, from 2011, Ann Coulter.
I now think it is true. You must understand groupthink and all these things about liberals I could never understand. I see it in a completely different way since about halfway through writing my book, just watching them talk on TV, all the slogans, and your head is so confused with their word salad, and so many of them. I know they have high IQs. I know they must do well on their SATs because they went to good colleges, and yet they seem so stupid on TV, like Paul Krugman or Frank Rich, Jonathan Alter. They seem so simple-minded. Well, that can be explained by Gustave Le Bon's book. I cite that throughout my book. He's the father of groupthink, and he says a man in a crowd will lose his intelligence. He becomes simple-minded. Can't see contradictions, is given to infatuation for leaders, and we certainly see that with the left for 50 years we have. All of their little behavioral quirks I now see in a completely different way. And I'd also add, I mean, I did keep thinking to myself, well, what would a liberal say about this particular group thing characteristic? How would they accuse conservatives of that? And I just don't think they can do it. I mean, the Messiah point being one of the most, I think, clear-cut ones. Conservatives don't worship their leaders. Most of the time, we can barely stand our leaders.
Well, I was just going to say, what gives conservatives as a group this a type of immunity, if you will, from the psychological effect of the mob mentality? Why don't Republicans turn into mobs?
I think it is a quality subtly alluded to a few books back, called godless. And that is, I mean, by and large, it just, I mean, it is a fact in polls, and half the time the liberals are lying when they pretend, the few who pretend to believe in God. If you believe in God, it's an up-down relationship, and you don't care as much horizontally what people think of you around you. If you don't have an up-down relationship with God, then what the crowd, what the people around you say, whether you're part of the in-group and the status and the elites, it becomes much more important. And in point of fact, for Christians, it's fantastic to be hated.
Well, thank goodness there's never in history been a Christian mob. See, this is why I'm having a little trouble, because, I mean, mob mentality, as you just alluded to a moment ago, can infect any human being of any particular political persuasion or faith. I mean, we've seen violence done all over the world in all kinds of societies.
I don't write about religious mobs, but Christian mobs have been relatively rare, certainly not in this country. You have to go back to the Crusades, and this is a Catholic church and a state thing, and the amount of bloodshed was pretty minor compared to, oh, Muslims today. But I'm looking at the political aspect of it, and you don't have political violence from the right in this country. You have liberals constantly warning of political violence from the right, but it's always the warnings. It's the threat of violence. It's never the actual violence. We get actual violence from liberals.
Well, we saw some pretty heated crowds during the Tea Party demonstrations of a couple summers ago.
I talk quite a bit about the Tea Parties. For one thing, I mean, a big part of my book is comparing the French Revolution and the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. I think conservatives are in the tradition of the American Revolution, liberals in the tradition of the French Revolution. You don't have the sloganeering that you hear. Just, I mean, turn on MSNBC and listen to Katrina Vandenhoevel, and it's like she's rallying the troops at Finland Station. It's a peculiar way liberals talk. Conservatives are far less prone to the sloganeering and the talking points. What the Tea Partiers, by and large, are doing is reading the Constitution and talking about the Constitution and saying you don't have an enumerated power, Congress, to be passing a universal health care bill. You know, they were upset the bill was being passed, but I think about the most randy they got was shouting, kill the bill, and liberals all said, oh, we're terrified. Well, okay, you get three liberals together, they're out smashing Starbucks windows and throwing rocks. You certainly didn't have the Tea Partiers doing that.
All right, now let me ask you, maybe I should back up here a little bit. So far in this discussion and in your book, you seem to be using the term liberal and Democrat interchangeably,
basically,
and the term conservative,
yeah,
and Republican interchangeably.
Basically. I would say 40 years ago, 50 years ago, there were still conservative Democrats, there were, mm-hmm, still liberal Republicans. Those entities are pretty much an extinct species now, and I think you can pretty much use those terms interchangeably.
Well, you certainly, if I may, demonize the Democrats quite a bit in your book.
I write about them.
You compare them to Hitler and Stalin and...
I talk about mob movements and the French Revolution influencing and being the template for the Russian Revolution, Mao's Revolution, Castro, Venezuela, Cambodia, Vietnam. And I say there are some aspects. Well, for one thing, liberals did support most of those revolutions in the pages of the New York Times from the administrations of Democratic presidents, FDR and Harry Truman. So, I mean, that's just citing facts. And I do think some of the left and the Democrats, the Obama administration, a lot of the things they do have mob-like tendencies similar to these revolutions. And that is the offer of utopia, the demand for immediate change, the ripping down of what exists, not gradual change, not, oh, we need an incremental, you know, cut to the capital gains tax, which is what you get from Republicans most of the time. But we are going to remake the American healthcare system in a way you have never seen before in this country. And don't worry, America, we know you don't like it, but my roommate and I are Rhodes Scholars and we figured it all out on paper and it's going to work great. We're going to provide free healthcare and it's going to save money. It's the all-you-can-eat chocolate cake that cuts calories.
And as soon as we pass the bill, we'll find out what's in it.
Right. That is so not what conservatives do. It's always a gradual, small change, reading the Constitution, going back to, I mean, there's a lot that needs to be repealed, but slowly. Even Ron Paul, though I kind of made fun of him for this in my column this week, but that was for another reason, even he isn't a purist on getting rid of what is clearly not within the Constitution for Congress to pass, Social Security and Medicare, and happens to be a Ponzi scheme, a literal definition of a Ponzi scheme. The current beneficiaries or people paying in now go directly out to the current beneficiaries. That is Bernie Madoff's plan. That is a Ponzi scheme. But even Ron Paul, who's as purist as you come, says we need a transition period. This is very different from we're going to remake the entire healthcare system in America.
After this short break, Ann Coulter's take on the controversy over the party switch.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 2011 conversation with Ann Coulter. I wanted to call attention. We very conveniently online, you can get the sample chapter of your book, The George Wallace, Bull Connor, Orville Faubus, and Other Democrats,
Love
in which
that.
You discuss why the history books that our children are learning from today conveniently leave out the fact that it was Democrats who opposed desegregation.
Yes.
They're Southerners.
Yes, amazingly. And Robert Caro's endlessly long, very wordy, three-volume works on Lyndon Johnson. He keeps talking about the segregationists in the Senate, but he doesn't call them Democrats, and they were all Democrats. He calls them Southerners. And in fact, of about a dozen of them, only one ever became a Republican. They always claim that, oh, the South went Republican when Republicans started appealing to the racists. No, the South went Republican when the Democratic Party went insane. It had a lot more to do with national security, with foreign policy. The Democrats are running a peacenik George McGovern in the middle of a war. The South was not going to stay Democratic long with the Democratic Party behaving that way.
You say essentially the Democrats simply switched mobs.
Yes, they did. Yes, they for the first time in my life, I became sympathetic to Nixon, not Nixon altogether, but Nixon's affirmative action plan. Mm-hmm. He created affirmative action. He was the first one to do it. And, you know, I'm a conservative and not of that generation. And I'm against race discrimination. I don't care which race is being by the government. I don't care which race is being discriminated against. And so that was something that conservatives never looked on favorably about Nixon. After reading through the history of civil rights in this country and 100 years of Republicans, bill after bill after bill, introducing immediately after the Civil War to give black civil rights, voting rights, anti-lynching bills, and all of this being obstructed over and over again by the Democrats and in sneaky ways by Lyndon Johnson. This wasn't just appealing to the base, because you don't have to be that sneaky in figuring out how to kill a bill with this killer amendment. Oh, no. LBJ was a segregationist. And you get so frustrated and angry. It's the way I feel now. Now about abortion and them not letting us vote on it, which is why I compare it to that. The first time the Democrats switch and to some extent, not as much as Republicans, support a civil rights bill is in 1964, because at that point, blacks are voting in numbers that it will hurt Democrats' electoral prospects. And still, that bill was only supported by about 60% of Democrats in Congress, but 80% of Republicans. And you always hear about Goldwater. Yes, we ran him for president. His objection to the 64 Civil Rights Bill, he had supported every civil rights bill until then. He was a founding member of Arizona's NAACP. He desegregated his family's department stores, Goldwasser's, I think, or maybe that was just his original name, but whatever. He was absolutely pure on the question of racial equality and civil rights, but he was a constitutional purist. He supported every part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act except the two provisions that applied to private actors, not government actors. Up until then, it had been all the federal government basically telling elected Democrats in the South, stop discriminating. This is the first time it applied to private action. And it would be, as I say in the book, as if today, after the Democrats fighting us for 40 years on abortion, if suddenly fetuses could vote and the Democrats decide we're appealing to them, they would introduce a bill in Congress banning abortion from Washington. Some constitutional purists on the Republican side would say, some would probably be like me and just be so angry and frustrated and say, yes, we're doing it. We're up with these Democrats. But some Republicans would say, we don't have the authority. This isn't what the state has to do. And then the Democrats would switch the entire history of the pro-life movement and claim they were the ones fighting abortion while Republicans were upholding rights to abortion, because that is exactly what it was on civil rights.
All right, so this leads me to the question I had as I was reading your book, is that what do we do with this information? I mean, you're not going to change Democrats or liberals' minds. So, conservatives, Republicans, what do you want them to do with the knowledge that their opponents are demonic?
Well, two things. One is to recognize the characteristics, and almost it immunizes people to the sloganeering, the simple-mindedness. Just like I say, I can't watch a political show now without seeing it through the lens of groupthink. And secondly, and this is crucial to the civil rights chapter, the reason I included that chapter is America, our history has always, people have always understood mobs are dangerous things, and they have been smashed and crushed, and the country has gone on. Because there will always be mob uprisings, there will always be evil in the world. I think the civil rights movement gave, the Martin Luther King civil rights movement gave a halo to mobs in America. And you will notice that liberals today, no matter what they are protesting, it could be a snail darter in the way of a government dam. And this is the new civil rights movement. Would you oppose civil rights for blacks? This is why I kept claiming my next book was going to be titled, You're Not Black. And part of the point of what I say of comparing Martin Luther King and Thurgood Marshall is that you wouldn't have Thurgood Marshall became he's the hero of my book because he was redeeming rights for blacks the American Revolution way. He was bringing lawsuits. He was making arguments in court. He was taking them to the Supreme Court, and he was winning those cases. And as long as a Republican was in the presidency, Dwight Eisenhower, he'd send in the 101st Airborne to enforce Brown versus Board of Education back in 1954. But unfortunately, in 1960, Nixon lost or had the election stolen from him by John F. Kennedy. And then we had 8 years of Democrats in the White House not enforcing civil rights. Why? Because they're appealing to their segregationist mob. Kennedy himself wasn't a segregationist. LBJ was. But Kennedy, as a Democrat, was appealing to that mob element within the Democratic Party. Once Nixon came in 1 year, he desegregated the schools overnight. He is really an unsung hero on this. But in any event, sorry, I brought that up to say point two I want people to take away from my book is mobs are bad. They are dangerous. They cannot be reasoned with. They cannot be coddled. Don't worry about, it will incite them to be. No, you must smash a mob.
Ann Coulter will be celebrating her birthday this Friday. She'll be 62. Now, you can get a copy of Demonic by Ann Coulter by tapping the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. Heardeverything.com is where you can also hear my 2013 interview with conservative radio talk host Dan Bongino.
We think elected officials have the power because we elect them, but what you don't realize when you're behind the scenes is they don't. Who really has the power, Bill, is a series of cronies, bureaucrats, paid-off insiders.
And my 2013 conversation with Project Veritas founder James O'Keefe.
If you Google my name right now, you'll just see awful, awful things written about me, even though the results of what we've done have been extraordinary.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, as we're now into the Christmas season, we'll be revisiting an interview I did some 30 years ago with the famed children's book author Tommy DePaula. Hit my 1992 conversation with him about his book called Jingle, the Christmas Clown.
Anyone out there listening who has children knows that when a child loves a book, you're in for a reading at least 40 or 50 times of that book to that child. And don't try to skip a page because they won't let you.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.